This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Suhib, and coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Really, unless the underlying economic interests of these networks and the communities are addressed, then it's very difficult to see how they'll be successful.
That's Tom Eaton, Timit, and a North Africa analyst at the London-based Royal Institute of International Affairs, talking about border issues in North Africa. Details coming up.
Also, Sudan, Libya, Chad, and Niger are jointly working to ensure border security, and a museum that opened today in Montgomery, Alabama, cast a spotlight on one of the darkest chapters in America's history.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story, streets were quiet in Tanzania today after authorities pledged to beat anyone trying to follow through with planned nationwide protest. The tension points to deeper concerns over the government's efforts to curb free speech and stifle dissent. Mohammed Yusuf reports from Nairobi with Khalid Abubakar in Dar es Salaam.
The new law in Tanzania targets online platforms like blogs, podcasts and other streaming live content. For example, via YouTube channels. The government says it will monitor the platforms for hate speech, obscene content, and threats to national security and public order. Local bloggers fear the oversight will be used to stifle dissent. Maxine Mello is the founder of Jamii Forums, a website about corruption in Tanzania. He has been detained several times since 2015. Including two formal arrests.
We have been through a lot of pushes from our government in a couple of past years because authorities wanted to know our whistleblowers, and we said we cannot do this. And most of these whistleblowers are the people who were helping to reveal some misconducts in the government. And as we speak, we are still facing three trials, and all of them are about revealing the sources of our stories.
Tanzania's government spokesman declined viewers' request for an interview. On Friday, the Tanzania Communication Regulatory Authority said the owners of online platforms must pay about $900 to get a license. The state agency also said it will use suspensions to force the removal of content it deems in violation of the law. Those who fail to comply with the new regulations could face fines and up to a year in jail. Reporters Without Borders has slammed the license fee as exorbitant and called the new law the latest blow to free speech in Tanzania. Since taking office in 2015, President John Magufuli has cracked down on a range of issues, including corruption, tardiness among civil servants, and criticism of his government. Newspapers seen as critical have been shut down or their licenses suspended. In February, two opposition politicians were jailed for allegedly insulting the president. Henry Maina is the East Africa Regional Director for Article 19, a global NGO that promotes freedom of expression and information worldwide.
Tanzanians are beginning to organize themselves online. And so here is a clear measure of a state policy to try and close down civic space. And in so doing, they are not only closing down the physical space, they are also closing down the virtual space so that Tanzanians cannot organize.
Maina points to a regional trend. Countries like Uganda, Democratic Republic of Congo and Ethiopia have cut the internet or restricted access to certain social media sites during times of unrest. Rights groups like Article 19 urge restraint.
There is a big discussion globally on how to perhaps regulate social media, but that must not be equated to criminalizing social media. That yes, regulation may be required, and if so, the regulation must be done for only three or four main purposes. One is for purposes of protecting the reputation of others. Two is for purposes of what will be narrowly described as national security. Three, public morality. And four, public health. Any other reason that states may throw up as a reason for regulating or control of social media in and of itself would be a violation of human rights.
In Tanzania, bloggers and administrators of other online platforms have until May 5th to get registered. Their licenses then will come up for renewal for a fee every 3 years. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Foreign defense ministers and security chiefs from Sudan, Libya, Chad and Niger have agreed to set up a mechanism to ensure border security. It will also fight rebel movements harbored in Libya, as well as combat transnational crime, human trafficking and arms smuggling. The four countries plan to hold a meeting of experts in N'Djamena on May 3rd to draft a protocol on security cooperation. Team Eaton is a North Africa analyst at the London-based Royal Institute of International Affairs. He talked with VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawy about the importance of addressing the economic and security interests of border communities.
I think it's difficult because when you look at these issues, you realize that much of transnational human smuggling, human trafficking and such activities, very important forms of income for border communities. And often, the very communities that are expected to police the border are those who often benefit from such activities. So I think that we've seen over the years in this area that whilst attempts to increase border security can have some impact, really, unless the underlying economic interests of these networks and the communities are addressed, then it's very difficult to see how they'll be successful.
So should these countries consider also the socio-economic factors that are essential for countering security challenges?
Certainly. I think you only have to look at the incomes that are available from certain activities such as human smuggling. It's my understanding that in Niger, the average income for a year could be achieved in a couple of weeks from transporting migrants. And so it's very difficult to tackle this problem without looking at these economic imperatives. And I think that this is something that policymakers have started to understand with the EU Trust Fund for Africa and certain investments to start developing and look at alternative livelihoods. But it still seems a very long way away.
According to the final communique, the four countries agreed to hold a meeting at expert level in the Chadian capital, N'Djamena, on May 3rd to study a draft protocol on security cooperation between the four countries to be signed at a later stage in Khartoum. In your opinion, what should such protocol entail?
I think that when you look at the other three countries, how do they sign protocols with Libya and which authorities are really able to implement such protocols? We've seen in Libya that it's got a highly fragmented security sector. And actually, there are quite a large number of non-Libyan militias operating within Libya. So the extent to which Libya is able to control its own security situation as a government is incredibly limited. So I think that will always have to be borne in mind with such discussions. That being said, I think a lot of effort is going into providing and improving border security. It's just difficult to see how successful that can be whilst the competition within Libya to control illicit smuggling routes and key parts of economic infrastructure is so prominent, particularly when you look at the south. We've seen a lot of fighting in and around the city of Sebha in recent months, and that connects to both national-level disputes and also local allocations of resources. So that's something that the UN-backed Government of National Accord doesn't have the capacity to resolve.
The Sudanese government has accused Darfur armed movements of fighting as mercenaries in Libya and southern Sudan. Is that the main reason behind Sudan's interest in cooperation with the other three countries?
But what I will say is that it is clear that Sudanese groups are operating within Libya. And also, if you look at the latest UN panel of experts report on Darfur, they allege that these Sudanese armed groups are involved in fuel smuggling cross-border and different forms of activity. And in fact, we've seen in a number of occasions within Libya that such groups have been contracted by various parties to prosecute their agendas. So this is something which is a growing trend within Libya, Chadian and Darfurian armed groups becoming increasingly prominent in certain areas, which raises fears for some. And I'm sure that that's something which the Sudanese government is watching with concern.
Tim Eaton is a North Africa analyst at the London-based Royal Institute of International Affairs. He was speaking with VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawy.
In South Sudan, the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, or UNOCHA, says 10 aid workers have gone missing outside Yei Town, the capital of Yei River State. OCHA says the aid workers' convoy was heading to Tor County from Yei Town early yesterday to conduct a humanitarian needs assessment when it disappeared. There are fears they may have been taken by rival military factions fighting for control of the region. In Yei, Daniel Friday Martin reports for VOA that the South Sudanese Development Organization lost contact with its team in the convoy yesterday morning. Stephen Luga, the executive director, says he appeals to whoever might have taken them to free the workers. The UN has called on all parties to the conflict to ensure a safe environment to allow the delivery of aid. This is the second time that aid workers appear to have been snatched by armed groups in April.
Members of an East African trading bloc are working to remove restrictions on travel by citizens of the eight states. The protocol is being drafted by the countries of the Intergovernmental Authority and Development, or IGAD. The group's members come from the Horn of Africa, the Nile Valley, and the Great Lakes region. The proposed document also would try to control the risks that come with greater freedom of movement, trade, and economic cooperation. The agreement may be finalized at the end of this year. VOA's Catherine Nambi files this report from Kampala.
The eight member states of IGAD are pushing for the legalization of informal movement of people that is regularly taking place in the member states. Delegates from Uganda, Kenya, Sudan, South Sudan, Djibouti, Ethiopia, Somalia and Eritrea are meeting in Kampala to come up with a political endorsement for fast-tracking the protocol on the free movement of people. JJ Odong is Uganda's Minister for Internal Affairs. He says the move comes in the wake of conflicts that have resulted in an increase in the number of refugees and asylum seekers among members of the trading bloc. A protocol would help regulate the uncontrolled flow of people.
We are trying to arrive at modalities to regulate the movement of persons. Movement can be both good and bad. Our intention is to facilitate the good movement and control the bad movement.
IGAD also seeks to regulate the movement of pastoralists among member states. Martin Lomuru is Minister of Foreign Affairs, South Sudan. He says the unregulated movement of herders has led to clashes, especially among communities in Kenya, Uganda, and South Sudan.
These are people who love moving with cattle. Some of them, their areas have no water and maybe desert. They may need to migrate and migrate freely because they now think, well, you know, it's free movement. Those kind of people need to be guided.
Lucy Daxbacha is a migration expert with IGAD. She says they are working to ensure that the protocol is adopted and domesticated before this year ends.
We are left with only one consultative meeting with the Federal Republic of Ethiopia, which we hope to hold next month in May. And after that, we are going to have three or four rounds of negotiations of the draft protocol, which the experts of IGAD Secretariat will present to the member states. So the negotiations will be platforms for then the member states to finalize on the technical provisions of the protocol. And we foresee by December we'll have adopted this protocol.
Although the protocol is enshrined in the 1986 agreement that established IGAD, member states have been reluctant to endorse it. But that's now changed. Recently, the African Union meeting in Kigali resolved to remove visa restrictions for movement across the 55 countries on the continent. That effort could help boost East Africa's economic outlook. Moreover, the region faced more economic migrants than they did 30 years ago, as well as a swelling number of internally displaced people and refugees. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
Coming up on 20 minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. The Nigerian military uses illegal oil refineries and burns seized crude oil in the creeks of River State, leading to heavily polluted air in the region. Residents say they first experienced the soot in August 2016, and it has continued since then. Experts worry that it may have consequences for health and environment. Robinson Tambari Sibe is an environmental consultant and a member of the Stop the Soot movement in River State. He spoke with reporter Mike Mbonye in Port Harcourt about the effects of the soot.
There are public health implications for this. Of course, we know that it triggers respiratory issues, especially for people within the vulnerable age, within the vulnerable range, people, children, the aged, and then people who already have existing conditions, existing respiratory conditions. It can trigger that. We also know that from a preliminary report, we are told that the constituents of the soot are carcinogenic in nature, which means it could trigger cancer, the cancer-causing substances. So we have that public health scare because people are exposed to it. Food items, you know this in Nigeria, food items are sold in the open, garri and all that are sold in the open, and we ingest all of this. So beyond that, there are also socioeconomic conditions, socioeconomic effects of it. We spend more time in the hospital, we spend more money treating children, we spend more time cleaning houses, and we lose man hours in doing all of this.
Has there been any response by governments, River State or the federal government, in limiting the suit?
Beyond the rhetoric, we haven't seen any concrete step, especially from the federal government. At the state level, yes, they did some level of preliminary study sometime last year, although we haven't, the report wasn't published, but I know they have also been having series of dialogue, series of meetings with the key elements and key actors in the hydrocarbon industry. I also know that they actually did shut down a couple of asphalt plants in the River State. But beyond this, we haven't seen much action from the federal government, who, by the way, are those who actually do control the hydrocarbon industry. All of the apparatus of states which ought to frustrate the illegalities in the oil and gas sector, they also control. They control the industry, they regulate the industry. Unfortunately, we only get to hear from them each time citizens threaten action, and it ends at a tweet or a press conference or mere Facebook post or something. We really haven't seen boots on ground or real concrete actions to stop this.
What should residents in affected areas do as first line of action to help themselves from the soot?
Self-preservation is the first law of nature. So if you happen to find yourself within the vulnerable range, I think it's good to limit outdoor exposure. If you're doing so, and if you have to do so, you wear a nose mask. Beyond that, also cover food items. I know a lot of our food items, we buy things in the open and all that. We need to try as much as possible to limit that. We also need to improve on our personal hygiene, because if we're told that the soot actually contains carcinogenic substances, it means that taking it in you know, could have potential effect, or having it on your skin overnight could also potentially have effect. So to, as a first line of preservation, of protection, you should improve on your personal hygiene, have your bath twice a day, limit your outdoor exposure and all that.
If the military must destroy illegal refineries or burn seized crude, what other options should be used to prevent emergence of soot?
First of all, there are best practices in decommissioning facilities like that, artisanal refining facilities. So burning it in itself harmful to the environment. You don't destroy the environment in the name of protecting or trying to frustrate an illegal activity. So what we recommend is controlled decommissioning. And of course, when they seize these products, setting it ablaze is not the best thing. They have to have some kind of dump, a bonded dump or a controlled tank farm where they store all of this. They can do further fingerprinting to find out exactly where the product came from. But beyond that, it should be decommissioned properly in line with best practices. Even the spot where they were doing the artisanal refining in itself, it should be treated as a spill site, because that place is already polluted. So it should be gazetted, it should be itemized as a spill site, and the clause or whatever actions that the air gasping recommends for first line of action when there is a spill should be activated.
That was Robinson Tambari Sibe, an environmental consultant and member of the Stop the Soot movement in Rivers State. He spoke with reporter Mike Mbonye from Port Harcourt, Nigeria.
A museum that opened today in Montgomery, Alabama, casts a spotlight on one of the darkest chapters in America's history, the lynching of thousands of blacks between the end of the Civil War until the Civil Rights Movement. The National Memorial for Peace and Justice isn't a typical museum. It is full of artifacts and objective accounts of events. It forces visitors to ponder the deaths of African Americans that were carried out for the smallest of offenses, like carrying a photo of a white woman, officiating at a mixed-race marriage, or asking for a raise. Brian Stevenson, founder of the Equal Justice Initiative, the nonprofit organization behind the memorial, calls it a case of domestic terrorism, and the facility draws a line from slavery to today's disproportionate share of blacks in prison, urging people to become more politically active and vote.
In Paris, authorities are probing allegations that the holding company of tycoon Vincent Bolloré used favors to win lucrative port contracts in West Africa. Lisa Bryant reports that he presides over a massive media, logistics, and transportation empire on the continent, even as France's clout in Africa is waning.
French investigators are probing allegations that Vincent Bolloré's holding company was given lucrative port concessions in Togo and Guinea in exchange for undercharging the current leaders of both countries for advertising work during their election campaigns. The Bolloré group has denied all wrongdoing and said the inquiry will give 66-year-old Bolloré a chance to answer what it describes as unfounded accusations. France continues to be a major economic and political player in West Africa, but its influence has declined in the face of more recent competitors like China and Turkey. Even so, the Bolloré Group remains a formidable player. Its interests include logistical operations, railways, ports, and media interests that turn over billions of dollars a year.
Le groupe Bolloré en Afrique, c'est un empire industriel et financier.
Interviewed on French TV, journalist Nicolas Vescovacci, who wrote a book about Bolloré, describes the Bolloré Group's Africa interests as an empire that spans 46 countries and employs 25,000 people. Vescovacci says the businessman controls what enters into the African ports his group controls and at least part of local economies in countries like Guinea, Togo, and Ivory Coast. Bolloré has also forged ties with powerful figures in both France and Africa. He's friends with former French President Nicolas Sarkozy, who's now being probed over alleged Libyan campaign funding for his 2007 election.
Au fil des années, il a tissé un réseau très important qui va.
Journalist Vescovacci says Bolloré has a network of relationships that range from former spies and policemen to politicians from the left as well as from the right. Now, Bolloré's relationship with two of them, Guinean President Alpha Condé and Togolese leader Faure Gnassingbé, is under scrutiny. French investigators are probing accusations Bolloré's advertising company, Havas, now run by one of his sons, provided discounted services to both men during their election runs in exchange for port contracts. In France, Bolloré is a controversial figure. Over the years, he's launched a number of defamation suits against media investigating his group's various business activities. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis, and thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga, host of VOA's Reporters Roundtable. Join us every Thursday as we discuss important African topics and events. I'll have a panel of African journalists and expert guests to discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. That's Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.